Back. Our next case is United States v. Casillas. Because this is a TJAG certified case, the government will argue first. Major Barros, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? And Major Johnson, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the defense? Very well then, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I am Major Vanessa Barros, and along with my co-counsel, Ms. Mary Ellen Payne, we represent the United States. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I would like to request 3 minutes for a rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. A conviction for possessing one file containing child pornography does not grant a license to possess 13 more 2 weeks later, even if the files were located on the same device. Yet, that is a practical effect of the lower court's opinion. But appellee's convictions concern different file types, different dates, and different victims. There was no plain and obvious double jeopardy violation. This court should reinstate appellee's conviction for possessing child pornography and affirm appellee's viewing conviction. Your Honors, I would like to begin discussing the reasons why the iPhone was not the unit of prosecution or the material in this case.
Before you do that, could you please address the issue of waiver, which you raise in your brief? So in that, you argue that the CCA abused its discretion when it pierced the waiver, but the TJAG did not certify that issue. So why should we reach that issue?
It's for this court's consideration because under the plain language of Article 44, it means that appellee agreed to be tried for the 13 PDFs and there was no error to correct on appeal. And for this reason, AFCA abused its discretion in piercing waiver here. But they abused its discretion too because there was no double jeopardy violation to begin with. And it goes into the first point I wanted to make that.
It sounds to me you're not going to die on that hill of waiver. You just wanted to insert it, but you're willing now to move on past that.
I believe we went on other grounds. Yeah. Obviously, there is the certified issue of waiver regarding viewing.
Right, but not in terms of possession.
I do think that It was waived. AFCA found that it was waived and they pierced waiver. And then they abused their discretion in piercing that waiver because there was no error to begin with. There was no double jeopardy violation.
And my only point is TJAG didn't certify that issue about the CCA piercing the waiver. So why should we address that issue?
I understand your point, Your Honor.
Okay.
But again, we do win on other grounds. So the iPhone was not the unit of prosecution, and this is where the lower court erred. Since child pornography is the material that contains a visual depiction, this specification literally alleges that appellee possess within the iPhone the material that contains the visual
depiction. How is that in any way consistent with Forrester?
I understand Your Honor's concerns of whether this is inconsistent with Forrester, but there are shortcomings with the Forrester opinion, and the same concerns we have here of how the lower court read the specification in
so you don't like Forrester, so you want Forrester overturned. Well, that's a whole different question. We can talk about that. I teach Forrester. Students hate it. So is Forrester's wrong?
Your Honor, this court need not to overturn Forrester's ultimate conclusion, but there are
shortcomings. Okay, so that discussion's off the table. So we're dealing with Forrester. Forrester is very clear. It says the unit of prosecution for possession is the thing on which the files sit. We had a computer, we had an external hard drive, another external hard drive, and then the Gmail account, which is weird. Maybe it was an email account. So. And the judges said that's four things that have child pornography on them. That's four specifications. Two of the judges thought it should only be one. You're arguing it should have been, 23, 600? I don't see how you get to that from Forrester.
I I think what's pivotal to understand in Forrester is that whether the government charged the individual files themselves or the devices, the court would have gotten to the same conclusion because the underpinnings of Forrester rested on the discrete act. So every time the appellant in that case transferred his child pornography to different devices, that was its own specific offense.
No, his offense was possessing child pornography on four different devices.
Correct, but even if you look at the plain language of the specification on Forrester, similar to our argument here as to why the iPhone was not the unit of prosecution, the material cannot be the device and on the device at the same time. And so the same reasons here why we find that the iPhone was not the unit of prosecution, because it cannot be, the material cannot be the phone and within the material, the same logic applies in Forrester. The material cannot be the device and also on the device.
I'm not following you. We have an iPhone, and it's got child pornography on it. So why is the material not the iPhone that contains the child pornography?
Because if you look at the plain language of the specification, the plain language of the specification says that the contraband or the material was possessed within the iPhone. An object cannot contain itself, so the iPhone and the material must be two separate things. I think.
So if the government gets very clever with the precise wording of their specification, they can circumvent Forrester and turn Forrester from a case that means the unit of prosecution for possession of child pornography is the thing on which the child pornography sits into something else?
I don't think this is a situation where the government is trying to circumvent Forrester. We ask that this court clarify Forrester.
What's unclear? I get that you don't like it. Lots of people don't like it, but I don't see where the ambiguity is. And Forrester itself, in a footnote, says there's good arguments to be made for the unit of prosecution being something else. What the dissent wants, there's just one specification, or a per-file approach. But that's not what the majority interpreted the president to specify in the manual. So where's the ambiguity in Forrester? Because even Forrester says there's other ways you could do this. This is not what we think the president wanted us to do. So where's the ambiguity?
I don't necessarily think that there's ambiguity in Forrester. I think it's how the court read the specifications in Forrester to determine that the devices were the unit of prosecution.
So, counsel, is it the government's position then that Forrester should be limited to its facts?
Yes, and Forrester should be narrowly construed because in that case you're dealing with identical images possessed across four different devices. Here we're actually dealing with different visual depictions of child pornography contained within different file types and also possessed within different dates.
Well, there's this argument, and it was first raised in the dissent below, about limited to its facts. I don't understand what that means. We had an individual who had 600 images of child pornography, and he's got it on across four different devices. And the court decided that's four specifications. What do we limit it? And why is that? Well, how do we limit Forrester? We have a different unit of prosecution for possession of child pornography in different circumstances?
Well, of course you can have different units of prosecution.
For the same offense?
For possession, yeah. Files can certainly be a unit of prosecution for possession.
Well, and Forrester specifically says we're not going to use files.
Forrester specifically stated, Your Honor, that it's not to use images as the unit of prosecution. It does not foreclose the idea of the government ever prosecuting a file as a unit of prosecution.
So we're going to treat a JPEG and a PDF file differently?
Yes, Your Honor, because a PDF file can actually contain multiple images of visual depictions of child
pornography. So could a JPEG?
Correct, but it would be that JPEG file or that PDF file.
But now we're talking files, and in Forrester they specifically said we're not going by files.
I would disagree, Your Honor. In Forrester says we're not going by images.
And counsel, just could Forrester partly be explained because you were presented with four different devices? So multiple images, some of them the same, but spread across four different devices. If it had been charged differently and they were charging them as images, the PDFs, the JPEGs, the whatever, is it possible that the court then would have been focused on files as opposed to devices?
You're saying in the context of force?
Mm-hmm.
I think that the court would get to the same conclusion if each file was its own unit of prosecution in Forrester, and each act of the appellant transferring all of his child pornography so that way all the devices can contain all of his stuff, that discrete act is a separate offense. And it's important to note here that appellee here possessed child pornography in two distinct dates. The PNG file, which was the basis for Casillas 1, was possessed on 22 December. 16 days later, he had a separate impulse to then possess 13 more images of child pornography.
Counsel, I ask this about Forrester. Is it your position that Forrester decided that it was sufficient that the images were stored on different devices, but not that it was necessary that they be stored on different devices? So, for example, if you had different images, one in the internal memory of the phone and one in an SD card inserted in the phone, would those still be stored on different materials under the government's position?
Yes, Your Honor.
What if we had them stored, there's just one central memory chip, I don't know anything about phones, but suppose there's sort of one central memory chip in the phone and they're stored in different physical locations on that memory chip. Is that different materials? Different files, but there is a chip, it holds, you know, however many gigabytes. This place has one file, this place has another. Are they stored on different materials?
Yeah, because the files would then be the different material.
Major Barris, you may not be able to answer this question, but what's bothering me, among other things, about this case is, as I understand it, there's a search by the expert, and they find some child pornography files, and then they proceed to trial on those offenses, right? And then later, the same forensic expert finds these other files. And during the first court-martial, the government wants to get those admitted in the court-martial proceedings. And the issue of whether or not this is a major change or a minor change comes up, as I understand. And military judge says, no, this would be, I think, says no, or concludes, no, this is a major change. Now, at that point, the option for the government, as I understand how this part of a trial works, is that the government could have chosen to simply withdraw, re-refer all of this material, and then proceed the trial with everything, couldn't they?
Your Honor, that was an option for the government, but they were not bound by that option.
No, I understand, but that certainly was the option. The next thing that happens, though, is that they then try to get it admitted as 404B evidence, and they're not successful there. So my question is, wouldn't it have been easier to simply withdraw and re-prefer and re-refer instead of ginning up a whole new court-martial? In fact, they're doing this, ginning up this new court-martial while the first court-martial is going on, the second court-martial. I mean, am I missing something about how?
Your Honor, you are missing something. And what I'm about to refer to is actually not in the record of trial for Casillas 2 because the issue of double jeopardy was waived. So we just don't have those records, those facts developed. But my understanding of Casillas 1, when the PDF files were then discovered by the expert, that was already after a few days of motions hearing. And so the government was already at an advanced stage after a comprehensive motion practice for 19 specifications. So then to withdraw and dismiss would actually be inefficient and cause significant delays. Does that answer Your Honor's concern?
I think so. I'm not sure I'm convinced that that makes it easier for the government or not, but I appreciate it. I understand.
But to expand on your point, the government tried to bring this all into one court-martial twice, and both times appellee objected. The first is what Your Honor mentioned was the request for the major change, defense objected.
As well he should have, right?
I mean, I understand your concern, Your Honor. Okay. But then the government then tried to join the charges after preferral of Casillas II, and an appellee objected to that. And at that point, everything was set to go for trial for Casillas I.
Yeah. Okay.
Your Honors, I would, given my limited time, I would like to move on to Issue 2 and... And ACRA properly upheld waiver with regards to viewing. There was a known right, which was the right to make a double jeopardy claim, and trial defense counsel purposely declined to raise that right. And we know that because we have the benefit of the affidavits. And I think viewing also, when you apply viewing to the case, I think it also applies why some of the shortcomings of Forrester, why it was error to put emphasis on the device versus the files as the unit of prosecution. Because for a viewing offense, it makes sense that individual files were the material being viewed because the government has to prove that the accused viewed the particular depiction or, in other words, opened that file. If the device is the unit of prosecution for a viewing offense, it makes very little sense because even if the screen is off, if you're just viewing your cell phone, does that make sense for a viewing specification? Of course not. The government would never meet its burden in proving a viewing offense.
So counsel, essentially is government arguing, you're not conceding necessarily, but possession would be a continuous course of conduct type of offense, whereas viewing is a discrete act or a distinct act offense.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I still think that possession can be determined by discrete acts, and I think what's helpful here is the federal courts that interpret receipt of firearms. And federal courts have universally recognized that different receipts of firearms equal distinct possessions, as the second court highlighted in Almeida. And this has been recognized by 9 other circuits.
So, but in this instance, you would say that the distinction comes because there were 2 different types of files with 2 different possession dates, as it were. We know that the PDFs were obtained or possessed at least 2 weeks after the original file. Okay.
I see my time is up, Your Honors.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Major Barris. Major Johnson.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Major Frederick Johnson, and along with my co-counsel, Ms. Megan Marinos, I represent the appellee in this case, Senior Airman Nathaniel Casillas. The government chose to make the iPhone XR the unit of prosecution, and it convicted Senior Airman Casillas for possessing and viewing illicit depictions on that physical medium. Prosecuting him a second time for the same offenses violated the prohibitions against double jeopardy. If his trial counsel waived this powerful constitutional defense, that failure constitutes ineffective assistance of counsel. This court should affirm the Air Force Court's set-aside of the second possession specification and further set-aside the second viewing specification. The double jeopardy in this case is clear from the text of the specifications, the manual for courts martial, and this court's precedent in United States versus Forrester. Looking at the specifications in Casillas 1, the first court martial, the government specifically highlighted that the illicit depictions were within an iPhone XR. Applying the plain language of the manual, that makes the iPhone XR the material that contains the illicit depictions. It is, in fact, a grammatically similar construction using the same language that the court analyzed in United States versus Forrester when it found that those physical devices were the media on which the illicit depictions were possessed. Applying that same reasoning here, the government charged, convicted, and punished Senior Airman Casillas for possessing and viewing the depictions on that iPhone XR.
Counsel, can I ask you this? It sounds like your argument involves two steps. One involves the device, and one involves what the specification says about the device. Could the government charge somebody with possessing pictures in the internal memory of a phone and in the micro SD card that's plugged into the phone separately? I mean, that, if they use the language of the specification right, would those be separate materials, even though they're both in that physical phone? One is the internal memory and one is the micro SD card.
Yes, Your Honor. That would be legitimate if the government used that charging scheme.
So the unit of prosecution, we can't just always say if it's the cell phone, that's the only unit of prosecution. But your argument is more sophisticated or more detailed, which is in this case they said the unit of prosecution was within the phone, and that would cover both in this particular situation. Am I understanding that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. It's certainly an argument that's specific to this case, which happens to use language that's very similar to what this Court analyzed in Forrester. And the Air Force Court really clarified the importance of that charging language, actually in another case, in United States versus Coley, which came out a few months later. So in that case, the Air Force Court sort of looked back at its decision in this case and said, we're not saying that this always has to be the unit of prosecution or that, you know, this would always be the case. But because of how the government charged it in that particular case, that's what led to the Air Force Court's conclusion. And that's the argument that we're making here today, is that applying the manual and the Forrester precedent to the charging language in the instant case and the case's precedent that produces the jeopardy, that is the outcome that the Court should reach, that Senior Airman Casillas was prosecuted for possessing and viewing on the iPhone XR as highlighted in that specification. And then when we get to the second court-martial, even though the specifications don't say exactly what the medium is, the Air Force Court found that it was, quote, abundantly clear that the images were on the same device. And not only are we talking about images from that same medium, but the charging time frames are essentially the same. There's a few days difference, but the charging time frame from Casillas 1 completely encompasses that from Casillas 2. So to the extent that the government now says that they were trying to make this different discrete acts, that's not reflected in the charging scheme. These were, over the same period of time, possessing and viewing illicit depictions on the same medium. And when the definition that's in the manual for court-martial is applied to that, that is the child pornography. Essentially, when the manual says child pornography means the material that contains, that material becomes the offense. And so when it's the government charges in Casillas 2 that Senior Airman Casillas possessed child pornography, they still must show what that medium is.
Counsel, so I understand your argument with respect to possessing, but I don't think Forrester says a word about viewing. And so so how does this work to this viewing specification?
Although Forrester didn't directly address viewing, Your Honor, Forrester was interpreting a definition in the manual, not a particular offense. And that definition applies equally to possession as it does to viewing, as it does to other offenses that have been specified by the President under Article 134. And Forrester also gives us no reason to think that the definition it interpreted should apply differently to different offenses that are in the same subsection of the manual. They're right next to each other in the paragraph.
The counsel is – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you had a follow-on question. Go ahead.
What? No, please.
Thank you. You said that Forrester, or we shouldn't interpret it differently, but if we were looking at this either through the lens as under UMC analysis, which is what Forrester started as, the court kind of morphed it, based upon the issue, morphed it into a multiplicity. Issue. But if we were looking at it in either one of those, through either one of those analytic lenses, you get to the actus reus. And so the actus reus of possession is different than the actus reus for viewing. So why shouldn't they be considered differently? Why, or the inverse of that question is, why should we apply the analysis that was used in Forrester with regards to possession to a viewing offense?
The analysis should be applied to viewing as well, Your Honor, because the definition is the same. And so the outcome of that definition should likewise be the same. And to the extent that the government now tries to argue that they were actually charging different things, especially with regards to viewing, that distinction is not reflected in the charging scheme that the government brought forth on these two separate charge sheets. They're the same, illicit depictions on the same device over the same time frame. Everything else about them is the same. And the government's further argument that there's some sort of odd outcomes when it comes to viewing is really precluded by the additional pieces of this offense. Because viewing, like possession and like other offenses under this subsection, must be knowing and wrongful, and it must meet one of the terminal elements. And so when the government says, well, if you just viewed a phone with its screen off, that couldn't possibly be viewing, that wouldn't be knowing and wrongful and meet the terminal elements. And so that argument is precluded by those additional elements. But where the government has charged two viewing specifications that involve the same material over the same time frame, the conclusion as to double jeopardy should be the same. If the government wanted to make a distinction, it should have done so when it charged this case, not now at this late stage on appeal. And just as bad as the government missing this point is the trial defense counsel missing this point and failing to raise a powerful constitutional defense that could have resulted in the dismissal of both of these specifications against their client. When the military judge brought up the possibility of double jeopardy in this case, the trial defense counsel responded with silence. Silence is the essence of forfeiture, not waiver. And for that reason, this court should conclude that these issues were forfeited, not waived, and should go ahead and analyze them for double jeopardy. However, if the court does conclude that that did constitute a waiver, that waiver was ineffective assistance. The trial defense counsel had the benefit of United States versus Forrester. It came out years before this case. And to read that case and not conclude that the same interpretation of the definition would apply in the instant case is simply a failure to understand the law and this court's precedents as they apply to those particular facts.
So, counsel, in their affidavits, defense counsel say that it was a strategic decision because after objecting to the admission of the evidence in Casillas 1 twice, that they felt it would be misleading or dishonest before the court to then raise a double jeopardy claim in Casillas 2. What is your response to that?
To the extent that was a strategic decision, Your Honor, it was not a reasonable strategic decision. The trial defense counsel successfully kept out the evidence in the first court-martial on evidentiary grounds. As Judge Sparks pointed out when speaking to the government, they were trying to get in as 404B, and it was ultimately a timing issue that kept that out. And I'll also point out here that it wasn't that the military judge found that it would be a major change. The government withdrew their motion to change the specification after the defense objected. So having objected to a major change into the timeliness of evidence, there's no reason to think that now in a second court-martial, they can't raise double jeopardy. There's nothing misleading about that. It's just answering the questions and raising the issues that are before them in an individual case. And if the government's decisions and their objections to those decisions set them up to be able to raise a double jeopardy defense, that's effective advocacy. That's exactly what they should have been doing at every step along the way. The real problem here is that they didn't understand the application of the law to this case. And that misunderstanding is apparent from the trial defense counsel's statements on the record. During argument, they said the government is allowed to charge every image that they find. They didn't realize that the image is not the unit of prosecution. It's the material. And yes, the government is allowed to hold someone accountable for as many illicit depictions as may be found on a single medium, but they did that when they convicted and sentenced Senior Aaron Casillas at his first court-martial. If the government failed to get in additional evidence that it had in its possession from the investigation here, If they failed to get that into court despite having it for that long, that's simply a government error. That's simply a learning point for them to do better in the next case. Senior Mikasiewicz' constitutional rights and his ability to assert double jeopardy as a defense should not be hampered because of the government's own shortcomings.
Counsel, in their affidavits, they also suggested that even though they might be meritorious on the possession charge, getting it excused under double jeopardy, they didn't think they had a path to get the viewing charge dismissed, and they thought there wasn't much benefit to be gained, even though they admitted defending two specifications is better, was worse than defending one. They just thought they didn't have any escape from the viewing. So what about that decision to they described it as a strategic choice not to raise it?
Once again, I would say that's not a reasonable strategic choice. There was great benefit to be gained because they had at least the reasonable opportunity to get the viewing specification dismissed. There was also almost no downside to doing so. If they had raised the double jeopardy motion and the military judge rejected it, as to viewing or to both, the issue is preserved and they can litigate the rest of the case just the way they did without bringing this motion. So there's no downside. And when it comes to the issue itself, there's no reason to think that the interpretation of the manual's definition that came first in Forrester should apply differently. It sets an intolerably low bar for trial defense counsel to say, well, if there's no case directly on point, then we don't know if this is going to be successful. The idea that you take the interpretation of a definition in one case and apply it to a new case using a closely related offense that encompasses the exact same definition, that's the very basic form of legal reasoning that we expect effective, zealous trial defense counsel to engage in when they represent their clients. And so to draw the line there and say, well, we're not going to do anything because the case we have giving us this interpretation isn't precisely on point, is still below the performance we expect even of fallible lawyers.
So, Counselor, did you have a third one? I'll hit the third one then. One counsel also said, well, he believed that they may have been judicially estopped from raising this as a defense. So is it your position that no, there would be no judicial estoppel?
That's correct, Your Honor. There's no reason to think that there would be judicial estoppel here. The trial defense counsel never argued that these were separate offenses. They never argued that this wasn't going to be double jeopardy. They simply opposed what they argued would have been a major change because it would have expanded the scope of the specifications in that first court-martial, and then later opposed the introduction of evidence as untimely. There's nothing about those arguments that stops them from then making a double jeopardy argument in the second court-martial. And the government could have fixed this, as this court pointed out, to government's counsel by simply doing all of this in a single court as a second court. The government says, well, that would have been completely inefficient, that would have actually made it worse. But it would have been not very different from what they ended up doing. Had they just withdrawn these two specifications, they could have gone forward on all the other ones and then had a second court-martial, which is exactly what they did anyway. These are problems of the government's making. It began with the way they chose to charge it, went on to the way that they tried to get evidence in when it was discovered at a late date, despite having been in their possession before. And even at that point, the government had the tools to address this, and it chose a different path. What it cannot do is obtain a conviction and a sentence for these offenses in the first court-martial, and then go back and have a second court-martial over the same offenses. Yet that's what the government did. And Senior Aaron Casillas has now served two different sentences, or is in the process of serving two different sentences, for viewing and possessing child pornography on the same medium. That is a violation of his right to be free from double jeopardy, and this court should remedy that violation by affirming the Air Force Court set aside of the possession specification and further setting aside the viewing specification.
Counsel, may I ask a question? If we were to side with you but wanted to give the government some guidance for the future, if the specification had said that he possessed the pictures in a particular folder on the iPhone, would that be sufficient such that he could then be prosecuted for possessing other images in a different folder?
Yes, Your Honor, that would seem to be sufficient in that circumstance if the government charges it that way. There could be other issues that a charging scheme might raise, depending on how narrowly the government wants to get down and what exactly they want to allege the medium to be. But those would be properly litigated in a case like that to determine whether something is a proper medium. A file or a folder, when alleged as the medium, when the government uses that charging scheme, would seem to be a possibility. Really, one of the things that the definition in the MCM does is it allows the government to craft a charging scheme that fits the evidence they have. If the government always had to charge by the file or by the image, some cases would result in long, unruly charging instruments. It makes a lot more sense there to charge by the device, as the government did here and as it did in Forrester. It's not that the government doesn't have ways to address this. It's that when they pick one of those ways, they must be held to the consequences of that choice. And the consequence here was that Senior Airman Casillas was convicted the first time around. The second convictions for both possession and viewing were violations of double jeopardy that this court should remedy. Pending any further questions.
Any further questions from the bench? Seeing none. Thank you, Major Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Major Barros?
So, Your Honors, the iPhone was not the unit of prosecution, because if you look at the plain language of the specifications in this case and in Forrester, it does not make logical sense that the iPhone was material. If the iPhone was alleged as the material, the specification would look something along the lines of possessed child pornography, to wit, an iPhone XR containing visual depictions. But Appelli is putting so much emphasis on the government's charging scheme, but this court is not bound to just look at the individual specifications. In order to determine double jeopardy, this court must look at the entire record, as this court held in Deere and as the Supreme Court held in Bros and Russell. And if you look at the entire record, there are five crucial points that shows that the individual files were, in fact, the unit of prosecution. First, as we've been discussing, there are different file types with different victims possessed on different dates.
But that was also true in Forrester.
Correct. But if you look at the military judge's instructions to the members in Casillas 2, the military judge identified each file, PDF file, as the material that contains the visual depictions. And there was no objection from trial defense counsel, so all parties were on the same page that the files were the unit of prosecution here. Also, the file in Casillas 1, the PNG file, was used as 404B evidence. And 404B evidence, by definition, is evidence of another act, a separate right or a separate crime or wrong. You cannot use the same crime to prove itself. So the fact that the PNG file was used as 404B evidence in Casillas 2 inherently proves that they are separate offenses. And trial defense counsel, as we have the benefit of their affidavits, they understood that the files were the unit of prosecution, and that's why they didn't file a double jeopardy motion, because there was no double jeopardy issue to begin with.
Counsel, I'm curious about you've emphasized time a few times. Is it the government's position that you can charge every day, every minute, every hour? What is the unit of time that you can charge for possession? So it can be charged, you possessed it on January 1st, January 2nd, January 3rd?
Your Honor, I don't believe that there's a temporal limit. I think you look at the actus reus to determine whether it was a separate impulse. And I think the Blockberger case is instructive of this, because even there, the Supreme Court held that even a separate narcotic sales to the same buyer, those separate acts, those were indeed separate impulses.
Those are sales, not possession.
Correct, but on the flip side of that, you could look at a possession, you can look at the receipt of each possession of being a critical factor, which federal courts have universally held that separate receipts of firearms equates to separate possessions of firearms. And the same logic should apply here. A perpetrator should not be able to, date by day, continue to possess control over more child pornography.
But that's not how it works with drugs. When you find a service member who has drugs, you don't charge them from every day you know they received it, right? It's just possession, right? It doesn't really matter when they received the drugs. It's when they found, it's when the government found the drugs and proved that the drugs were in their possession.
Correct, but I would say that in the context of possessing.
But why wouldn't we treat child pornography like, well, he'll cut you off if he wants to. But why wouldn't we treat this like drug possession? Just, it's possessed. But I'm not sure why in this circumstance time is so important. You've emphasized the 2 weeks difference of when the files were downloaded, but they took his phone and they found child pornography on his phone, and then later they found some more child pornography on his phone. It's not really sure why that turns into two different time periods of possession.
Well, they found more child pornography on his phone contained in a different material, which were PDF files. And I think what's
crucial. But you emphasized that it was downloaded at a different time.
Correct, 16 days apart.
So I'm just curious, what is the unit of time that the government wants us to adopt as what creates one set of, so, you know, I imagine the files get downloaded sequentially, they might be a few minutes apart. Is that enough to be different acts of possession?
This court doesn't need to make a bright line rule over time, but I do think the facts here, because appellant possessed these images 16 days apart, it was not some continuous.
Received them 16 days apart. And
received and then subsequently possessed.
Okay.
And so because it was 16 days later, there's no doubt that appellee here was acting on separate impulses.
Any further questions from the bench? You may briefly conclude.
Yes, Your Honor. Appellee agreed that these files were distinct at trial. He should not now use his device as a shield on appeal. This court should reverse on possession and affirm on viewing. Thank you.
Thank you, Major Barris. Case is now submitted, and the court thanks counsel for both sides. Before we adjourn, however, we have another matter to attend to, and that is the passing of the gavel ceremony. Now, as some of you may know, by statute, a judge on this court may only serve as chief judge for a maximum of 5 years. As of July 31st, I will have served as chief judge for those 5 years, and therefore I will be stepping down. But don't get too happy and excited. I still have 2 years left on my 15-year appointment. I just won't be chief judge. As some of you also may know, by statute, the judge who is the next most senior on the court typically would become the new chief judge. The next most senior judge to me is my friend and colleague, Judge Sparks. However, for personal reasons, Judge Sparks has decided not to accept the position of chief judge. Therefore, I am delighted to announce that Judge Maggs will become the next chief judge of the court as of August 1st. I can think of no one who is better suited for the position of chief judge than Judge Maggs, based on his intellect, temperament, and professional experience. He is a distinguished jurist and scholar. His dedication to the court as an institution is unparalleled, and he previously served as the interim dean at the George Washington University School of Law, which means that he's both highly experienced and highly skilled at managing an organization. All of us here at the court are truly looking forward to having Judge Maggs serve as our chief judge, because we are absolutely confident that he will be superb in that position. I and the other judges pledge to him our cooperation and support. Now, as I close out my tenure as chief judge, I wish to make a few brief points. First, it has been an extraordinary privilege to serve as chief judges of our court, as we as a group have continually and faithfully strived to play a full and vital role in ensuring that justice is achieved and that good order and discipline is maintained within the United States Armed Forces. Second, I'd like to thank my colleagues on the bench. What a wonderful group of people to be associated with. During the past 5 years, we have developed a particularly collegial and collaborative approach to decision making, not only when it comes to cases, but also when it comes to issues affecting this court, such as budget, human resources, security, facilities, IT, and the independence of this court. Third, I'd like to sincerely thank the career employees of this court. Truth be told, being chief judge of this court is extremely easy. I discovered that you just need to rely on the phenomenal people who are the true backbone of this court. I'm talking about people like Mr. Dave Anderson, Mr. Ed Rivas, Ms. Renee Lee, Ms. Agnes Gang, Ms. Marilyn Savage, Mr. Holman Barsmeri, and Mr. Joe Lusk, among many others. Fourth, I want to specially thank our superlative clerk of court, Mr. Max Squires. Now, I first met Mr. Squires 3.5 decades ago in the sands of Saudi Arabia during Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm. And then 5 years ago, when he was serving as the clerk of court over at the Army Court of Criminal Appeals, and I was about to become chief judge, either I recruited him or he recruited me. I'm not sure which way it worked. But I do know for that the past 5 years that I've been able to rely completely, extensively, and unreservedly on his wise counsel, his common sense, and his uncommon devotion to the mission, purpose, and operation of this court. So thank you very much. Fifth, I want to thank my own chamber staff for their assistance with my chief judge responsibilities. This includes my law clerks during the past 5 years, to include my current clerks, Eric Grasha and Jordan Allen. I'd also like to thank my Commissioner Rob Monahan, who as the former chief judge of the NMCCA, has been particularly insightful on a host of issues that have confronted me in my role as chief judge. And I can tell you that all of these people, my fellow judges, the career employees of this court, Mr. Squires and my other chambers personnel, all universally and unanimously agree that the true shining star throughout this five-year venture has been none other than Ms. Kelly Walker. Although her official title is judicial assistant, it is no exaggeration to say that her real role in this court has been as chief of staff and counselor. It is no exaggeration to say that she knows everyone, everything, every event, every process, every challenge, and every solution in this courthouse. And she rolls up her sleeve every day. She does so with good humor and a can-do spirit and tackles anything that comes our way. So, Ms. Walker has been my indispensable right arm during my tenure as chief judge. And so it is time for me to symbolically pass the gavel to Judge Maggs as he prepares to assume the duties and responsibilities of chief judge on August 1st. So, Judge Maggs, do you have anything to say, to share about your upcoming tenure as chief judge?
Chief Judge Olson, thank you for those generous remarks, and thank you also for your outstanding service these past 5 years. All of us are deeply grateful for your wise judgment, steady leadership, and exceptional administrative skill. Working with the outstanding staff you've assembled, those you've named, and others in the building, you've made the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces one of the best-run federal courthouses in the nation. You've been a superb steward of our resources, maintaining our courthouse and our facilities in excellent condition while remaining well within budget. You've excelled in strengthening the broader CAF community through events that recognize our dedicated employees, that welcome our outside counsel, and that foster public confidence in the military justice system. Chief Judge Olson has carried out many responsibilities with distinction, but those of us who regularly appear in the courtroom know that one of his favorite duties has been swearing in new members of the bar. He welcomes each new admittee warmly, and without fail recites the inscription engraved above the main entrance of his alma mater, the University of Virginia Law School, that those alone may be servants of the law who labor with learning, courage, and devotion to preserve liberty and promote justice. Chief Judge Olson, we can all agree, has embodied that learning, courage, and devotion throughout his tenure on this court. The same can also be said of our truly esteemed colleague, Judge John Sparks, whose grace, experience, and intellectual rigor have so greatly enhanced the stature of this court. Before every oral argument, I quietly remind myself, try to ask questions like Judge Sparks. Challenging, yes, but always courteous and friendly and respectful. I'm not sure I succeed, but I do try. As this gavel now passes to me, I count myself extraordinarily fortunate to begin this new role with not one but two distinguished senior colleagues, Judge Olson and Judge Sparks, whose counsel and wisdom will help guide us forward in the right direction. Thank you.
I just want to say again that both humbly and sincerely that it has been a true privilege to serve as Chief Judge. The court will stand adjourned until further order of the court. Bailiff?
All rise. The court is adjourned until further order of the court.